Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful question.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books. And you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I love it. And it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Welcome, book lovers, to another episode of Words and Nerds. Oliver Pomervan joins me today to chat about his new book, Natural Born Loser. What I love about Oliver is his positive and joyful voice and inclusion of cultural diversity in his books. Oliver and I discuss school life, bully mons, writing about your own experiences, diversity, and burgers. What a joy. I'm your host, Danny V. Welcome, Oliver. It's such a joy to have you on the podcast today.
It's lovely to be here, Danny.
We're going to chat about Natural Born Loser, but I wanted to say that I taught Tyrific to a Year 7 class way back, I think it was in 2010, and the kids absolutely adored it, and I've been a fan ever since.
Blast in the past there.
It is. And what I loved most about Natural Born Loser was that kids could really see themselves in your characters, particularly in the diversity of their abilities and their cultures. And looking at your work, this is obviously an important thing for you to explore in your novels. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, before I got into writing, I was actually a primary school teacher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all my teaching pracs and even just doing work was all in Western Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also where I grew up as well. So, you know, when I got into writing for kids, I really wanted it to reflect the kind of schools that I was teaching at, but also the kind of schools that I was at when I was a kid as well. Just to, I guess, show the kids that, like, you know, they can write about themselves and they can use places around them in their stories.
Yeah, and that's something I really noticed, because you didn't shy away from the fact that the school is tough and you're constantly judged and there are bully mons, which I liked that terminology.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And for some kids, school is and can be torture. So it's really interesting that you said, you know, you've experienced that and then you write about it.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, they feel like they need to write about, like fantasy, like, you know, somewhere far away, like, you know, like in Hogwarts or in another world, or even when it comes to school, it needs to be at what people think a stereotypical school would be like. But I always say that, like, you know, sometimes the most extraordinary things happen in your own life. So I always tell kids to write about themselves in their stories, and I'm sort of trying to sort of lead the charge.
No, it was really good. And I found it really refreshing too, to read from that different setting. Do you have students tell you they really connect with the school issues you present?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's amazing, even to this day, like, the kids, they love the fact that, you know, talking about, like, friendship and talking about unlikely friendships and bullies and just trying to fit in. Like, you know, I guess, you know, being a teacher and all, like, I've come accustomed to being really observant when it comes to classroom politics, you know, like, what's cool and what's not cool, and just seeing friends in my classes that I've taught, where they kind of ebb and flow, like, you know, they're best friends for a while, then they're not, and then something else happens, and then they're friends again, and it's just fascinating to see, and yeah, like, you know, I really do love writing about those kind of things.
Yeah, it's really hard being a kid, isn't it? I see that too, the relationships and the friendships, they, you know, come and go so quickly, and they do ebb and flow, and it's difficult to watch, I think, as an adult.
Yeah, you know, it's something that we take for granted, you know, like, and I think, like, you know, once you get older, like, friendships become much more complicated, I think, especially for kids, because they are stuck in that school or in that classroom for a very long time. So if you don't have many friends there, you are, like, those 6 hours would just sort of drag on. Mm. So, you know, I always tell kids that, you know, to survive school and even high school to an extent, you just need, like, 2 or 3 friends, you know, 2 friends at best, because if that other friend's away, you've got someone else to hang out with.
That's it, perfect.
yeah, that's right. So, yeah, you know, just a handful of friends, you know, like, I guess, you know, I'm not saying that everyone needs to be popular, everyone needs to have a whole bunch of friends, but I find that, like, yeah, you know, definitely you do need to find your tribe, and you do need to sort of be yourself to attract people that you can hang out with.
Yeah, I think that's good advice for kids as well, because I think kids are always kind of, like with the bully mons, they're pressured into doing things, or like Raymond doesn't ever think he's good enough to do something.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, you know, a lack of confidence is quite contagious, because if you never tried anything in your whole life, like, you know, the thought of actually trying it and having a go kind of scares you, I guess. And you know, for Raymond, he's happy to fade into the background. He's happy to be a follower. He's happy, even though he doesn't really play soccer, he's just happy being surrounded by other people on the soccer field, as opposed to being like a Nigel or having no friends sort of somewhere in the corner. So for him, it's a really big deal for him to actually say, okay, well, I've actually got to step it up here, and actually, now that I'm a prefect, I need to actually kind of do something.
And it's important too to have others believe in you as well. I mean, I loved the principal who really wanted to make a difference and saw something in the students that they didn't. I think they're really important role models in our schools too.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Humble was such a pleasure to write, actually, because he's inspired by a principal friend of mine who I saw as a teacher, just really influenced the kids in such a positive way. Like, he's the kind of principal that would never be in his office. He would always be out and about, high-flying kindergarten kids, out in the playground. And the way he would memorize names and know something small about each of the kids that he would greet in assembly and out in public was just astonishing. And I find that, like, you know, the school that I described, Berrijong, it's that kind of school where it's a revolving door of principals. You know, principals come and go, and staff morale is quite low, and as a result, the kids' morale is quite low. And Mr. Humble, you know, he's no Mary Poppins kind of principal, but he just does the small things right, like just making those connections with the kids. So, yeah.
But despite this, I mean, you do explore serious issues, and I really like that because, you know, they're kids' books, but I think it's really important to explore these issues as well. But I always find that your books and your social media posts are just so joyful and positive, and you bring that light into your book. So you really have those serious issues, then you have this real kind of, you know, silly, joyful aspect of it too. Is it hard kind of combining those, or does that joy come sort of naturally to you?
You know, I think it comes to the fact that, like there were certain parts of the day in my job where I had to, like, just sit and reflect that, wow, I'm actually getting paid for this. Like, today I did a school talk where they had, like, a giant sort of Hungry Caterpillar plushie, and I just sort of wore it like it was a scarf, and I started to dance around with the Hungry Caterpillar. And I just thought, I get to actually do this for a living. So it's so cool. And so I think, like, working with kids, like, it really is the fountain of youth, because you can't fake it, you know? Like, if you're there in front of kids and you're not feeling it, the kids will see that straight away, you know? They and so for me, you know, I just kind of leap into this kind of persona where, like, you know, anything goes, and I always act like this could be the last day that I could be as an author, I guess, before it all comes falling apart. So I need to kind of, like, have that mentality of just having a bit of fun. And, you know, I find, like, you know, I always want to be the point of difference. So, you know, I always want to sort of break down that barrier that authors are meant to be serious, and author talks are meant to be, you know, quite sort of formal. And you know, they can be at times, but, like, for me, I want to kind of flip it on its head and just have a whole lot of fun. And, you know, I kind of follow from, like, the Miles Grossman kind of train of thought where, you know, you can talk about some really, you know, serious and personally, like, touching things and things that really kind of cut deep. But when you do it from a kid's perspective, he just has a way to sort of make it, just kind of like, he'll try to find the light in the most darkest of his situations. And so I kind of want to take that on board as well when I talk about things in my books.
And isn't it nice, like you say, to make reading really fun for kids? I mean, you know, I feel like we're kind of competing with all that screen time, but I feel like books are making a bit of a comeback. And, you know, people like you and the authors are making reading really fun again, because it shouldn't always be serious, should it?
Yeah, you know, I think if anything, we have to up our game. You know, like, I think the days of just talking about the book are over. Like, you really need to sell it in a way where it kind of engages kids. And not to say that you need to throw plushies at kids and sort of kind of, like, muck around like I do. But I think that the kids really do attach onto a voice. And if you are quite genuine in the way you speak and the way you talk about your books, the kids will latch onto that. And So I find that, like, these days, especially when it comes to covers, cover design, the way books are promoted through social media and videos and things like that, like, yeah, I find that books have gotten actually much better at selling that message. It's no longer read this book because it's good for you, because it's a book. It's actually read this book because there's some really fun and exciting things in this book that you need to kind of want to find out about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you said that you write from personal experience, which I think is really important, especially your particular experiences, because I think they speak, you know, diversity. But how did your ideas emerge for Natural Born Loser?
Yeah, so this was a combination of past and present. So I find that these days now I'm kind of two characters two personas in my character. So I'm the kid in the story, but I'm also the teacher / author visiting all these schools. And so as a kid, I would have done anything to become school captain. You know, I would have looked at those badges and a little bit like, my precious. And, you know, just wanted to have that kind of like aura of being a school captain, you know. And it didn't help that I had a major crush on the female school captain as well, so that didn't help. So I had this like fantasy of like, you know, being by her side, kind of like, you know, king and queen of my primary school. But also that realization that, you know, as much as I was a class clown and a form of entertainment in terms of like, you know, being in class, I was never leader material. Like, you know, I think teachers and kids would not want me being the first kid that they see when they come into a school. Like, you know, if I was going to meet a politician or someone really famous or superstar or something like that, they wouldn't want me at the front going, hello, welcome to our school. So I think that kind of kicked in quite early when it came to like election time. And, you know, normally if you want to be a prefect or a school leader, you need to sort of, you know, put your name into the ring and the teachers will pick up 10 people to do speeches. And I got up to the speech stage and I don't know, like, I thought, okay, if I make the kids laugh, you know, the kids would vote for me. And I did make kids laugh, but then when I really thought about it, like, nothing that I had in my speech was actually much of substance at all. Like, you know, it was just making kids laugh. And so I kind of looked at it at the wrong point of view. And the kids that got picked anyway were the sporty kids, or they were the popular kids, or the really smart kids anyway. So I didn't really stand a chance. And so Raymond was kind of like that kid inside me where, like, you know, oh, like, what's the point of trying hard, you know? What's the point of doing it? Like, they're going to vote for someone much more better than me anyway. And not just Raymond, but also, Rhonda as well. Like, you know, even though she's the smartest at Berrajong, she feels that no one would pick her anyway because she's not popular. And then the other side of Natural Born Loser came as a primary school teacher, you know, fresh out of uni. I did a lot of casual teaching at schools around Western Sydney, and I'm not going to name any names, but man, oh man, there were some tough schools. That was like baptism by fire. Like, you know, that was just like, you know, and look, kids will always push casual teachers anyway, like, especially if it's their first time at the school. But I really did learn, like, you know, the hard knocks of casual teaching, just teaching these schools. So I used kind of those experiences as well and sort of throw them into my experiences as a teacher and also as a kid into Berrajong Primary School.
It's wonderful how all that time before when you were doing it tough as a casual teacher, it became research for your books. How great is that?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's kind of funny because, you know, I did primary school teaching as a backup career because they encouraged us writers back in uni when I was doing my writing degree to do a dip ed. So I did a master of teaching and I chose primary school teaching instead of high school because I didn't want to get bashed by kids. And I thought that that primary school would be way more fun. And so I did that, fell into it, loved it so much. And I taught for full time for 1 year. And that gave me the confidence to quit and say, yep, I think I'm going to give writing a go. And if it doesn't pan out, then I could go back to teaching. And that's absolutely cool. But looking back, I realized how precious and how important that year of teaching was, because that really did shape my kids' stories. Like, you know, I actually wanted to write for adults before I became a teacher. Like, I wanted to write really sharp satire for adults and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until I became a teacher that I realized, oh, wow, I'm still a big kid myself. So why not write for kids instead?
That's a great story. I really like that. I really like how you're inspired to do that. And I hear so many teachers, you know, have become writers. You know, Tim Harris is one of them as well. And I think it's so great that
teachers
have all these, you know, hidden talents.
Yeah, you know, because as teachers, we're at the coalface. You know, these kids don't hold back. There's no filter. There's no inhibition. they would just let you tell you how you feel. So if you're having a bad day, they will tell you, sir, you're having a bad day, aren't you? And you're like, yeah, I'm having one of those days. So it's great. And that's the one thing I miss about having my own, about teaching is I miss having my own class. You know, I miss having 30 little characters running havoc and chaos in front of my eyes. And so one of the things I love about being an author visiting schools is that I get to still see some of those kids come to life when I'm doing my talks and workshops.
I think working with kids brings you out of that kind of serious adult business as well, and they do bring that joy back into your life and that unpredictability and spontaneity that, you know, you kind of get stuck as an adult because you have to do all these important adult things, and the kids kind of bring that back for you. I think it's nice.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And, you know, even though I've done these school visits for over 8 years now, like just little small things that the kids say or things that happen at the school. It could be like they had a concert the night before, or the school carnival is coming up, or there's something random that happens in a classroom. I will kind of use that in my talks to kind of keep me fresh, but also kind of bring it back onto the kids that they will say, oh, wow, he's actually kind of making stuff up on the go. So it's pretty cool.
And you can only ever get away with that kind of honesty when you're a kid, right? Once you become an adult, you can't get away with that anymore.
It's true. You know, like, you know, I always got in trouble as a class clown because I said the wrong thing at the right time and vice versa. So so, you know, a lot of Lenny and a lot of Connor in the earlier books were kind of just that brazen kid, you know, the rebel kid that would just say anything for a laugh, but kind of like try to flip authority kind of on its head.
Well, what is your writing process? Do you plan a lot, or are you just kind of free writing? What's your process?
So it's a bit of both. So Tyrific was just free flowing. It was just making myself laugh and just sort of seeing where it takes me. Condit, on the other hand, was very stringent. So it was like I would put key points of a chapter on sticky notes, and I would just use a flip chart and I would just sort of shift them all around. These days, it's a mixture of like I would write a quick synopsis just to give the penguin to let them know what I'm doing. And then from there, that's kind of like my loose roadmap of where the story would take me. But I never really followed that. Like I would start using it, but then halfway through I would either skip it or I would deviate another path, and so I kind of use that as a kind of like a springboard. So a lot of my stories these days, they come through a first draft where it's like vomit and you just let it all out. You don't hold back. Like if some of it's really bad, some of it's just like I can't even describe it, but it's just like conscious of thought flowing along, just having words on the screen, because that will give me the confidence to work on the second draft, and that's when the magic happens for me. That's when I start shifting things. That's when I start editing and really thinking about the characters much more deeply.
I think it's good advice for students as well. I mean, I'm a high school teacher, and kids kind of don't want to write anything unless it's perfect. And I always do that free writing with them. I'm just like nonstop, just don't take your pencil off the page, just keep writing. And even though you are writing like what you call vomit, you can pick out some real gems like amongst it and then create your second draft. So I think it's really important advice for kids as well, writing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm not one of those authors that waits for inspiration. So, you know, a typical writing day for me at home would be 6 hours. And it could either be 400 words or it could be 400 pages. But it doesn't matter because I'm literally in front of the laptop just writing. And, you know, some days it's great, other days it's not. But I kind of want to put that discipline into it because, you know, it's one of those things where if I don't keep chipping away at it, the deadlines will come closer and then I'm going to be avalanched, swamped by an avalanche of kind of like words that I have to come up with. So I find that, you know, with my latest book that I'm working on right now for next year, you know, I wrote the first 10,000 words in like 6 weeks, and I thought, yes, this is it. This is gonna be a cinch. And then for 2 months, like, I barely got up to like, you know, another 2,000 words, and like, what happened? Like, I just don't get it. And then so I trust the process. You know, I know that whether it's a deadline or whether it's something in my head that will click, but something will happen. Like I can't explain it, but just that something will kick in. I'll solve something. I'll have a breakthrough, and then all of a sudden it just starts flowing again. So, yeah.
And that's coming back to that self-belief in it, isn't it? I like that, trusting the process. I think that's really good advice.
Yeah, because you know, even though like I've had all these books kind of published, like, you know, it is still quite scary because I've spoken to other authors who've written, like, you know, like, for over 30 years, and they say it doesn't get any easier. Like, you know, it's still quite hard. You're still quite measured by your last book. But at the same time, you can use those past books to give it a confidence to go, okay, well, you know, you've been here before and you got out of it that way, so just keep going. You know, you'll find a way, so...
Now, your books, The Other Christie, is a CBCA notable book for young readers and shortlisted for Yabba, Koala and Real Awards. Ty Rufik and Con Nerd are in the Koala Hall of Fame. Tell us about how you first became published. So you left your year of teaching. You said, no, I'm going to be an author. How did that work for you in terms of publishing? I hear all sorts of stories about publishing. I'd like to hear yours.
Yeah, so what happened for me was I gave myself five years to give writing a crack. And the first thing I did was I joined the writers group. So I went to New South Wales Writers Centre, joined the writers group, and it was led by Alicia Dinerson, who is a published author herself, who's quite a dynamo now. And I basically just, you know, joined a writers group. I had a deadline every 2 weeks. I had to produce something. And that was great because that gave me... I guess that gave me the thick skin that I needed to continue as a writer, because once you put your writing out there, people are free to criticize it and give you feedback. And I took that all on board, and that was really helpful for me. And then from there, I started to kind of network with the CBCA, with Skibby, and all other kinds of like festivals, including the one at the Writer Center. And I managed to win the first line competition with one of my first lines from Tyrific. And so that gave me kind of a foot in the door with one of the editors for a publisher. And then from there, I managed to meet a manuscript assessor, and I was just telling him about my my story, Tyrific. And he said, oh, well, I'd love to have a look at it, because I'm also an agent as well. So I said, okay, great. So I gave him Tyrific, and then... yeah, from there he kind of took me on board, and then the rest is history, I guess. But you know, that kind of took 3 years though, so that took a lot of me, you know, having these high moments of being at a festival, winning the comp, and then having that 9 months of like, oh man, I've got to produce something really good here. My manuscript needs to be perfect. It needs to be great. And then kind of like seeing sort of opportunities slipped as well, because. By the time I wanted to give it to that editor had already left that publishing house. So I thought, oh wow, back to square one. So that journey was good in a way, because in the meantime I met other authors, and you know, I'm quite thankful that the kids author community are so helpful. You know, I met, you know, Tristan Banks, Kate Forsyth, Belinda Morell, and they treated me like I was already a published author, like I already had books come out. And, you know, they were giving me advice, they were giving me helpful tips and hints as well. And so I felt really encouraged by them. And so I reckon, you know, it is a bit of luck, but at the same time, you need to make your own luck as well. So, yeah,
that's great advice. And I do agree. I feel like the Australian book community and community of authors, they're just such a beautiful, helpful, supportive, positive force.
Yeah, you know, we're quite lucky. And it's great because we would see each other at festivals and we'll get to catch up there and then. And then we won't see each other for 6 months. And then we'll see each other again for a couple of weeks in a row because we just happen to chase each other through festivals or schools and things like that. And so it's quite cool because as writers, we don't really have colleagues, but these are the closest thing we have to colleagues. And it's wonderful. Like, I'm really thankful that that I have these other authors and illustrators sort of on my side. And you know, it's wonderful to kind of like go to each other's book launches as well and support each other that way as well. And it's really cool to see all these young authors and some of these new authors kind of rise up as well. So we always want to pass it forward and give them support and encouragement as well.
Are you also a supporter of Room to Read, as is Tristan Banks, a wonderful non-profit organisation that reaches out to kids all over the world with books and giving them the power of literacy? How did you get involved in Room to Read?
Yeah, so that was through Suzanne Gervais. So she used to have like this monthly networking evening where we all catch up and talk about how our writing is going. And I caught up with Suzanne, and Jenny Orchard was there as well. And at that time, she was the head of Room to Read in Australia, trying to run operations from Sydney. And so you know, spoke to Jenny, learned about Room to Read, and it just really struck a chord with me because, you know, it's amazing the thing how we can take books for granted, but even, like, having books for granted as well. So, you know, like, there were countries out there that, you know, don't even have access to any books. And what I love about Room to Read is that they come at from a very wholesome point of view. So it's not like they'll just send a whole lot of books over to an overseas country like Laos or Cambodia or Vietnam. What they do is they get local authors and illustrators in those countries to actually write, design, draw the books themselves, print it over there. And then so that way that kind of like cultivates this this kind of industry happening in their local area. So so I've been a big supporter of them since then. And it's really great because I think, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you know, living in Australia and all, like, it's quite easy to take things for granted, but it's always good to have a global approach when it comes to reading and for literacy as well.
Yeah, and I think it's really accessible too, because I think the current the organisation currently are raising funds, and it's only $365, so it's $1 a day basically to give a girl an education for a year. So I feel like it's easy money to raise. They're not asking for a lot.
Yeah, no, that's right. And you know, it's kind of funny because it's a bit of a cliche to say, oh, you know, education is the key that unlocks you know, people's lives to something better and brighter. But you know, it really is true. And it's not just one girl that gets affected when she gets that education. It's the family around her, it's her siblings, and she can pass it on to other people as well. So I think it's really great. Like, you know, and yeah, you know, this year we had that campaign of 50 schools, 50 girls, and I think we're kind of like chugging along, but we can still do a lot more. So yes, I'll keep waving the flag for Room to Read, and hopefully we can reach our target.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. I hope so too. Can you tell us anything about the current work in progress?
Yeah, so the working title for this next tree creation is called Don't Follow V, and it's a story about a daughter of an Instagram mum who's sort of mapped out her whole life on Instagram. And after 11 years, she's finally had enough and doesn't want to be followed anymore by her mum and her 100,000 followers. And so it's this kind of story that I wanted to write about for a long time because, you know, now that Facebook and Instagram have been established for years now, like you have this generation of kids whose whole life has been up there on their parents' social media. So, you know, back in my day, you know, my mum would have all these embarrassing baby photos and stuff like that, but they're locked away in albums that no one would ever see unless you come to my house. But, you know, these days now, it's just everywhere. So I wanted to write that story about, you know, what happens when a girl who's kind of famous on social media and how does she deal with that in real life? Well, what does it look like for someone who's quite popular in the virtual world and all she really wants to do is just be left alone in the real world?
Wow, I'm actually really looking forward to that. I feel like that is so relevant and I think the kids will really connect with that story.
Yeah, you know, it's something that I really wanted to write for the longest time, and the thing that scared me was, you know, it's about social media, and so, like, you know, it's like putting MySpace into a story. You know, you don't want to kind of date the book. But then, like, you know, I read Gabrielle Williams' My Life is a Hashtag, which I absolutely loved as well. And I thought, wow, like, so, and then I spoke to my editor about it and she said, I think we're at a stage where, like, social media is kind of going to be here for a while. Knock on wood, of course, you know, Instagram might fall under this year. It could be something else that, you know, Hipzo or Capri or some other social media fad might happen. But, you know, like, but at the same time, it's still that process of, like, you know, having two identities and how do kids these days deal with having that online identity and their real life one?
Yeah, that online presence, because like you say, the baby photos, there's no permission given, is there? And all of a sudden you've grown up and you're 11, you've got all these photos on you that you never asked to be in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not like you get to sort of get go when you're 2 years old, kind of in the bathtub. And so it's really cool because, you know, it also gave me a chance to write about other kids who are using social media as well. So like you've got someone in there who loves eating burgers and puts them up onto social media. I wonder who that could be about.
And you know what? That is just such a great segue for my next question, but carry on.
Yeah. And there's also people who want to use YouTube to stream their gaming and all that kind of stuff as well. So, you know, it's funny because you ask kids what they want to be and they say YouTuber, and that's actually a legit thing to do now. Yeah. So, you know what? So I wanted to kind of like, you know, tap into their kids' minds and sort of see how that works and what they really want to do.
So now segueing into burgers.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Can you tell me about your burger obsession and when this started?
You know, it all started when I was a kid. Brought up on Thai food, you know, and going to this party at McDonald's and having a cheeseburger, and it was a love at first bite. And I just knew that this was something crazy. Like, you know, it was just, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you know, you always want something that you can't have. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, I always looked forward to having KFC, McDonald's, Pizza Hut, Hungry Jack's. You know, those moments really stayed in my mind. Like, I still have, like, this fuzzy feeling about having a Happy Meal, and I don't know if that fuzzy feeling is the clock iris inside me or if it's the high blood pressure, but I just it just gives me this kind of like tingly feeling of like childhood bliss. And so that has carried on through up until I became like an adult, I guess, and I could eat whatever I want. Oh yeah. So how I travel is I go to schools and I go to all these places, but then when I settle down, I'm like, okay, where's the best burger place, and hit me up. So yeah.
So what makes a great burger, Oliver?
You know, it's the simple things, you know, like you have to nail the freshness of the vegetables and the toppings, the salads on the burger. The bun has to be quite soft but not too soft. But it has to be the patty. You know, you have to nail that patty. It has to be juicy, flavoursome, and I'm just kind of getting hungry now because I'm actually going on to have dinner afterwards.
I think everyone listening is now hungry.
Yeah. You know, it's that perfect package. You know, it's when you take that bite and it just hits you all at once. I mean, burgers are called a meal in a hand for a reason. It's because you have to nail all those elements to make sure that it just packs a punch when you bite into it.
Well, I've posted on social media my love of Burger Frank. This is way out in Camden area. So when you're ready, drop me a line and we'll go and eat some burgers. And I'd love to hear your opinion on these ones because these are my favorite.
Oh, fabulous. Well, you know, I'm always on the outlook for like seeing great burgers, but also kind of like having a burger go list as well of the places that I want to visit. So the next time I'm in Camden, I'll definitely hit up some burgers for sure.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Oliver. As expected, it's been such a joy to talk to you, and I loved Natural Born Loser, and I can't wait for your next offering. And I really enjoy your joyful, positive posts on social media as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. And a great hello to all the Tree Gum Gums out there on the podcast. It's really great to be a part of it. And can I just say, nerds rule forever. Oh,
absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Thank you, Oliver.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.